Hi, this is Chris Pearson. Douglas resident James Fenton is 103 years old. At the age of 20, he enlisted into the British Army, and Bombardier James Fenton was sent as part of 178th Field Regiment of the Royal Artillery as part of the 14th Army, which became known as the Forgotten Army. After basic training, he was posted to Borneo, the journey itself being a challenge, before he fought with the 14th Army until the Japanese surrender. Hear his amazing story as part of Manx Radio's VJ Day 80th anniversary coverage.
I'm a Lancashire man, born actually in Church, and that's a small town, but I wasn't there very long. My parents moved into Oswaldwistle. And that's where I stayed then until I joined the army. You know, my upbringing and childhood memories, school days, they're all from Oswaldwistle, near Blackburn. Between Oswaldwistle is between Blackburn and Accrington.
And of course, if we think of World War One, we think of the Accrington Pals, of course, a very famous story.
Well,
as well.
You should, yes, because I had an uncle in the Accrington Pals, and of course, my father. He was in the First World War, but, as I say, because of his age, he never got into action. He got as far as training, and he was training in North Wales. And then, of course, the First World War ended, which meant that he was lucky enough not to have to go into action.
Your own service, you had your primary training, or basic training as it's now called. Tell us about that. Where did you do your primary training?
I did the primary training in Carlisle. The primary training is to get you accustomed to army life, really.
Being shouted at.
You read the rules and regulations of army life so that you're not to cross them. And it's an initiation. And it lasted 6 weeks. And during that period, you'll learn all about the drill, the ranks of the various officers, and the do's and don'ts in the army, as it were. And you get really used to army life. After this particular training, then you are assessed for what might be the best service that you can be placed in. How it came about was I was just chosen as the army. When my call-up papers came, they were assigned to the army, so I didn't have any choice whether I was army, air force or navy. From Carlisle then, after the initial training, it was decided that I would be sent for training with the Royal Artillery as a gunner. And this was after the 6 weeks. And that was way further north from Carlisle up to Edinburgh. So I spent about 6 months in Edinburgh training as a gunner. But during that period, I did lots of things. I finished up, actually, recommended as a signaller because I learnt the Morse code, which was, of course, people wouldn't understand today because that's long since disappeared, but operating wireless radios and also a telephone exchange. But also, when you get these separate jobs, you could also be a gunner, and you have to be able to fire the gun or actually operate with other people, other gunners, on the gun itself. And we were on 25-pounders in Edinburgh. Now, that's a very common gun for the Royal Artillery, a field gun. The position I got was number three on the gun. Number three is the chappie that has to lay the gun. Now, the word laying the gun means that you have to sort it all out, get it level, and you have to position it to actually fire. And when all this is done, you actually pull a rope or pull the handle and fire the shell. And that's the operation of number three. But there are six people to the 25-pounder. We went into action, first of all, with these 25-pounders when we moved abroad. But these were taken off us and we suddenly changed. And we were given what was called, classified by many people as a screw gun. And the screw gun is the one, it's a mountain gun, it's the smallest field gun in the artillery. But it takes more men because it can be pulled to pieces and carried. Each man can, one man can carry one wheel, one another, and the barrel itself comes into two pieces, it unscrews. And that's why they called it the screw gun. In fact, if you like to look up Kipling's poetic history, you find that he has written a poem about the screw gun.
So I guess that's a bit like we used to see the field gun race happening as part of the Royal Tournament, with the gun being stripped down, taken across fences, reassembled. It was that kind of thing, was it?
That was the case, yes, but fortunately, I never saw it stripped down. We went into action with it. I think it was stripped down when they were flown into Burma, because that was the only way they could get the guns into Burma. But I wasn't actually working on the gun then. I was more operating as a signaller. Therefore, I never really got the chance to actually pull one to pieces and put it together. And in fact, that was very rarely done. And I don't even remember it actually being done, even though we took it up mountains. And that's the reason for it, because you can carry it up a mountain quite easily if you've got it stripped down into six or eight pieces.
So you were acting largely as a signaller, a scaly back, as they would have been called at the time. You were carrying a fair amount of weight then, I'm guessing.
There's another good thing, because with the artillery in Burma, in that case, no, we had no problems, because, of course, you had to have a quad to actually tow the gun. I mean, we didn't pull the gun personally, so it was necessarily to have transport. And because there was transport, then there was another small vehicle attached to the gun called a limber. Now, the limber is the one that carries the ammunition. Now, once you've got all these together, of course, you've got to get the gunners. So they had a quad, what was named a quad. This is an RA vehicle where the gunners actually transported with the gun, and that will sometimes tow the gun. So you've got the gunners in the quad with the gun behind you and the ammunition behind that. So it was quite a trail, really.
It's a big logistical thing. Let's take you back. How did you get to Burma?
Yes, that's an interesting story, because it was a long, long journey. Of course, when at the time that I was actually drafted into the army was at the time just as the Japanese started to invade the places, and it was 1942. Now, the Japanese had already started raising hell in the Pacific, and of course, when it came time for us to go into action, when you're ready to go, you don't know where you're going. You all say, we're going to go off now to get to a unit, which, of course, you don't know where the unit's going. And so much secrecy, you didn't know anything at all about it. And there was all sorts of guesses and remarks about people, where we were going and what we were going to do. And it wasn't until we were on the boat leaving Liverpool that we actually found out we were off to India and Burma.
And what was your thought at that stage? How much did you know about where you were going to?
What do you mean? Geographically?
Geographically, but also about the action that was going to be happening there.
Oh, well, yes, because the Japanese were raising hell, weren't they, out there? And we knew that we were going to have to tackle them. We didn't know what part of the area in the Pacific we were going to, of course. And then, but the reason, first of all, was you have to get to India, and because it's a different climate altogether, you had the training then to get accustomed to the actual climate, the jungle, because all your uniform is changed. I mean, sweating out in the sun and learning all the problems about jungle warfare and the fact of disease and problems like that. We had to be very aware of cholera and insect bites. Malaria was another thing. And we were taking tablets to fight malaria, even in India, before we went off to Burma. When we'd finished our training in India, this was in Pune, where we've been training. Now, Pune is on the west side of India. Therefore, we had all the way across India to go, and we went across India by train all the way up to Calcutta. It took us quite a few days travelling by train on the Indian Railway. We changed many drivers and on the way, and of course we had lots of stops for various reasons. It took us quite a few days, but once we got there into Burma, then our next occupation was, we decided they were sending us into Arakan, because the Japanese at that time had decided to make attacks on the Arakan area.
What were your first impressions? We talked about the heat, we talked about the insects, we talked about on malaria and things like that. Also, the equipment, the way you presumably you look after the equipment is vastly different in the jungle to how it would be if you were fighting in Europe.
Well, the one thing that's completely different, mosquito nets. Because you couldn't, during a period when mosquitoes were very lively, you had to put up your mosquito net. And there were regulations. After sundown, you were not allowed to wear shorts. Or you had to roll your sleeves down, because the mosquitoes were terrible at about that time at the night when they were very active. And this was always a regulation. You had to be careful about certain things like that. But also, you had to worry about the insects. And two of the most serious ones, of course, or brands, were snakes and scorpions.
And you have to watch out because they get into your boots at night and all sorts of things.
Yeah, that was the first thing you did when you got up in the morning, if you'd survived the night. You got hold of your boot, turned it upside down and give it a good shake just to make sure there's no foreign mess in it.
So for a boy from Lancashire, suddenly arriving into the midst, let alone the fighting, and we'll come to that, but just surviving and being in that environment must have been very different for you.
Well, it was, because I saw you were with a new band of fellows, but you soon got accustomed to them, friendly with them, and obviously picked out the best friends that you were near. But that mainly was due to the fact of what position you were in the battery, because if each battery had different groups doing different jobs, therefore you would have some mates that were more close to you all the time. You got to know everyone in the battery, the whole people, the sergeants and sergeant major and everybody. But if you the actual part of the battery that you were in service with, of course you became very friendly, even though you were friendly with all of them, really.
But it's a second family, isn't it, when you're that close to people, I guess?
Yes, yes.
So you were there, you arrived in Burma, you're set up. What was the action like? Were the Japanese shelling you regularly? Was it living with that all the time?
That was the biggest problem. We were shelled every night without fail. And you could be sure. We used to set, come on, set your watch. We used to set our watches almost, because I don't know why it was the favourite time. Maybe it's because of the actual areas that we were in the jungle, but the Japanese always used to shell us through the day, but not as much as they did at night. And I think that was what they called nuisance shelling. We used to call it nuisance shelling too, because we used to do the same thing. As long as you're shelling people throughout the night, they're not going to get much sleep, are they?
So it breaks them down in the resistance and everything. Yes. Else. Outside of the action itself, what were the living conditions like for you and your oppos?
In camp it wasn't too bad. And first of all, Carlisle and Edinburgh, I was sending reports home to my mother. I said, I've got some lovely rice pudding today, but it wasn't quite as good as yours.
Keep mum sweet, that's important. Did you have anything in the way of entertainment? Did ENSA, the live entertainment, come as far as Burma or not?
Well, it did, but I never saw any of it. Because there was a few people went out there entertaining. There was Vera Lynn and other places. She never came to our unit.
She told me a very interesting story a few years ago about being in the jungle, and she left a picture in one of the camps, and many, many years later, some other people came across that picture was still stapled to a tree or pinned to a tree in the Burma jungle.
Oh.
Incredible. She was very impressed by that. Moving on from the entertainment, the 14th Army, of which you were part, were led by General Sir William Slim. What were your thoughts on him as a leader?
Oh, he was brilliant. And we seemed to have good progress under Slim. But my other general, the one in charge of the division that I was in, was Major General Festings. And he was a wartime soldier or a permanent soldier. I think his family were soldiers as well, right, dating back many years.
You mentioned a few moments ago the letters home to your mum about the rice pudding. Did I understand it right that you wrote letters from your first day in the army all the way through until your very last day in the army? Is that correct?
I did, from the very first day. And as a result of that, when I sent them home, my father, he was quite astute, really, and he had a bit of education, and he was quite sensible. And he said that he was saving all... He said to me, in a letter, sending it home after I'd sent a few, "I'm saving all your letters so that you'll be able to read them and reminisce afterwards when you get back home." Now, I thought very little about that. I knew he'd done that and saved the letters. When my parents died, they both died at the same year, actually, 1880. When I was clearing out the place, I came across the letters. I'd never even thought about them since, because I had moved on and I was living in London, not in Lancashire, and I used to visit them. But of course, not being in touch every day, those everyday things were missed. And I never realised about the letters, although I guessed he must have had them somewhere. And when I found them, every letter had been pushed through a little hole in the corner on a long string, and the long string was about 12 inches long.
So 40 years on from when you wrote them in 1980, you had the chance to reread them again. What were your thoughts when you read the letters you'd written all those years before?
When I did that, because I say my parents had died, I came across the letters, amongst other things, and I started to read them. And I thought, oh, yeah, like my father had said, you'll be interested to read these later on. And when I started to read them, I'd had a good memory about the war at that particular time. But when I started to read them, they became so interesting to me. I thought, well, I'm going to write these out. What I did, I started to edit them. By that, I mean, there were so many things in the letters about family matters. You know, somebody getting married or somebody having a baby or who was doing what where and everything. So as I started to edit the letters, all the actual personal details that were of little value to anyone else, I just left them out. But I started to write up this story of my life actually in Burma. And it transpired that of these, I finished up with 440 letters that actually produced, was the prediction of a book, which I later sent away, and I did have it approved, and it was printed. It was called The Forgotten Army.
What did it mean to you to sort of all those years later when you finally saw a copy of the book and know that your experiences were out there for others to read? What did that mean to you?
It was amazing. The interesting thing, though, I think, slightly different probably to many other books, the fact that I'm an artist. In fact, I trained as an artist. And that's how I went from art school into the army. So whilst I was throughout the war, I was painting whenever I could. I preferred watercolour painting because oil paintings wouldn't have been very satisfactory moving about in the jungle. You could just start something and somebody say, "Come on, the Japanese have retreated, we're moving." so you'd have to pack everything up immediately. And having a watercolour, and also it was much easier, you could just get the paints set it sorted out and take the pictures. And so I did quite a lot of sketching, and it was the results of these that were actually illustrated the book that I had.
We'll come back to that artwork in a second. Those original letters of yours are now stored as part of the Royal Artillery Museum at Lark Hill on Salisbury Plain. What does that mean to you to know that those letters are still being used for reference and research?
Well, that's very interesting to me, because they probably have other bits of material, but what they have there, they have an artilleryman's history from the very first day he joined the army to the very last. Now, if you think about this, I must have been writing, these letters must have been about at least two a week, often three, because apart from the letters that I'm sending here, I was writing other letters. There was a fairly large, my mother had a large family, sisters and brothers, and I was writing to all these people as well. So the amount of letters, it was actually 440 recorded in the book, but I think there must have been one and a half times as much again as that.
Wow, out there. You touched on the artwork, you touched on the paintings, watercolours as opposed to oil, but photography became a thing for you as well. I'm just envisaging this. Tell us, you're in Burma, you're in these austere conditions fighting a war, but you managed to start processing and printing your own photos, didn't you?
Well, there is a regulation when you're in action, or during this war anyway, and I think it was also applied to the First World War. You were not allowed to take a camera into the front line. This was in case you were overrun by the enemy, and they had proof of many of the secrets that they could find out from the details of the photographs. It was the same in Burma, and I was only dependent on the sketches I was doing and sending home. And as the Japanese were being, rooted from Burma, and they were moving down from North Burma down to Rangoon, time went on and they were being expelled. News came around and said, if anyone has a camera, yeah, we'll allow you to use it now. So immediately I wrote off and said, look, send out the camera. But I'd been using a plate camera. This is one of the more difficult types of cameras to use in warfare, really. To use a roll film camera is a much easier and simpler job. You just put the film in.
When we talk about plate, that's glass plates, isn't it? Which presumably could shatter and break.
Yes, they were. It was a plate, what is known as a plate camera. The size of the plates, 2.5 inches and 3.5 inches. So they sent me out the material, the camera, which I still have to this day. And they sent me some negatives, their old glass negatives. It was difficult to get hold of film negatives for the actual plate, for the camera. One of the other things was, if you had these out there, what was going to be the results? So they also sent me out chemicals, because I'd also been processing chemicals before. I was interested in photography, having been interested in photography. And my father had taught me a lot, because he was an amateur photographer. He'd won one or two prizes in local exhibitions and things. And I learnt that from a very early age, all the interesting features of developing and printing from cameras at that time, because, the Leica was only just sort of coming up, and they were very expensive, films of that, cameras of that nature, so, and roll film cameras too, they were quite popular, the roll film camera, but the plate camera is distinct, because you can really get an accurate picture and you can focus it to the actual finest detail or operate it much, much better. So that was an advantage.
What did your oppos, what did your comrades think of you doing these paintings and the photos and everything else?
Oh, they didn't take much notice, really. And I don't think they understood the whole situation, really. The big problem was that I wanted to know how the actual photographs were going. And as soon as the camera came out, and they sent me some chemicals to actually process the chemicals, how was I going to do that? Actually, there were in Burma, when you are fighting with a unit, with the type of the artillery unit I was, even infantry people, you always have a two-man slit trench guarding the whole area. So I was in a slit trench with another man. Now, when I needed to develop the prints, I would get a tarpaulin and put it over the top of the slit trench and develop the prints inside the actual slit trench. All the negatives were processed in the dark under a tarpaulin in the Burma jungle.
So no red light, you couldn't see what you were doing, and also, presumably, trying to keep the temperature of the chemicals steady must have been difficult.
Oh, that was terrible. It was necessary to use a thermometer. And that was a big problem, because the slightest variation in temperature can vary the length of development and how it's been exposed, and you had to be very careful not to get any light in. If I want to talk about one occasion when I'd had taken some negative, I could only the plates for the camera would only hold 6 negatives. So that was the limit. Once you'd taken 6 negatives, you were stuck. And you either had to take them out and process them to load another 6. Or even if you took a couple of negatives, then you might want to process those. So you'd wait and get down night time and process them. And there was one particular night time, and you had to choose your time very carefully. And I'd said to my friend who was my pal in the slit trench, I said, look, I'm going to develop some negatives tonight. Cover me over with the tarpaulin. And he said, OK. So everything looked peaceful and quiet. So I settled down inside and I was halfway through developing some negatives. Suddenly the Japanese opened up. Shells were flying everywhere. And he came rushing to the side, and I shouted, God, don't you turn that tarpaulin back, because if there'd been a flash or an explosion whilst he was looking underneath, I said, you go and find somewhere else. So I had to carry on developing the negatives whilst the shells were dropping around, and he scurried off to join another trench somewhere else.
Oh my goodness, that's an incredible story. That's remarkable. How long did you serve in Burma for in total?
We arrived in Burma in March 1944, and I served in Burma right until we got the Japanese out of Burma. Or that's not quite true. They were still fighting in Burma. But because of my unit and what I was being trained for, we'd been trained as an assault regiment. And now an assault regiment are the ones that go in first, unfortunately. And, of course, that's a terrible ordeal. And that's what we had trained for. And that's why we had these small guns, because of them being very transportable. As the war was improving for our conditions in Burma, and the Japanese were slowly being kicked down south, went down as far as Rangoon and further out, they decided that my unit then had better regroup, and we came out of Burma, went back to Pune to retrain, because we were then going to regroup and land on the Japanese mainland.
Wow.
And it was whilst we were training in Burma, in India, preparing, you know, for this new landing, I thought, well, not many of us are going to come out of this. We knew what that situation was. And at that time, of course, suddenly the news came round, they've dropped the atomic bomb. Well, that was a great relief. Although there was no immediate ceasefire of everything, because the Japanese weren't convinced that this was the end of the war, we really knew that at least our lives had been saved by this atomic bomb.
at the stage when the ceasefire was announced, General Sir William Slim issued a famous note to the troops to talk about how well you'd fought and how the 14th Army had done itself proud. How did you hear about that? What was the first you knew it's over?
Well, we had radio. You see, and being a radio man, being a unit that had radios, we could usually tune our radios in to the radio stations, even in India as well, and we used to get news that way, as well as by letter. But of course, the news. I can remember that I was just. I was changing places at one stage, and I think I was laying on the ground, and suddenly, this was just a few days after the atomic bomb had been dropped, and I'm just laying on the ground, and suddenly, some guys started running riot all round the place, saying, "Oh, the Japs have surrendered," and goodness, so that was a great relief.
And how long was it then before you were finally able to travel back?
Well, because I was the army has very strange ways of getting people out of the army, and initially at that time, because the Britain was in a sorry state, they were letting the people out first of all, even if they hadn't been in too long, if they were essential workmen, builders, and people producing things, the men that had actually workshops and joiners and things like that, they were all released early on. Now, I was an artist, I was a long way back. And because of that, and I still had time to serve, I was sent out to Singapore and Malaya.
So for you, the war wasn't over, to quote a famous phrase.
I was happy about it in a way, because once the war was over and you felt safer, I was seeing a bit more of the world.
Absolutely, and somebody else was paying you. His Majesty was paying. You eventually did come back, you demobbed. Why did you choose the Isle of Man to come and live on eventually?
Well, I'm a photographic historian, amongst other things, and I had, after the war, I started collecting material related to photography, cinematography, and stereoscopes and things like that. And this was whilst I was living in London. I was freelance designer in London with one or two clients that I was working for, doing artwork. So this was an opportunity. When I went out to see my clients, very often I would be passing antique stores or shops where they had anything that was second-hand stuff. And it was from this era that I amassed such a huge collection of material, of everything, right from the very first days of photography right up until the present day at that time. And this was all being stored in my home in Kingston-on-Thames in London. And it just grew and grew and grew. And finally, when, as time was getting on, I thought, well, I'm going to be retiring shortly, or I will try to retire. I looked for a place and opened a museum. And I tried several places in the world. I wouldn't like to name them all. New Zealand was one. We went to New Zealand. I almost set up the photography museum in north of Auckland.
But eventually, the Isle of Man.
The reason that's I don't know whether you call it fortunate or what, but it was a very strange situation. Because of I'd amassed this large collection of historic material, and a lot of friends of mine who were collecting this type of material, they were just specialising in certain items. One might just be roll film cameras, another might be images, certain types of images, and magic lanterns, lantern slides. But I was collecting everything because I was, you know, so interested in the whole history. And I had been doing lectures around the place. I'd even been abroad lecturing, And I went to America lecturing on the history of photography to George Eastman House, which is the home of Kodak. How it came to be that I finally did find somewhere, my wife was... This was in Kingston, where I live. My wife said, I'm just going to pop out doing some shopping. So I said, OK, off you go. So she disappeared shopping. I don't know what I was doing at the time. But she came back in, and when she came back in, I just said to her, Lillian, I said, you must sit down. She said, well, what for? I said, well, let's sit down. I said, I've booked a holiday. I'd been studying the paper while she was out shopping, and I'd seen this advertisement for a holiday place in the Isle of Man. I was very familiar with the Isle of Man, but I'd never been. So I thought, this sounds interesting. But I hadn't the faintest hope or thought about a museum. So obviously I booked this holiday, came over. And the minute I came over, by car, of course, I was driving the car and stayed at this place. Driving out, I drove down to Port Erin. And in Port Erin, there was a huge shop that was actually a jeweller's shop. And when I looked at this, for sale, it said on the notice. So I thought, I'd make some inquiries. I said, Lillian, look, that place, that would make a museum. So I'd make some inquiries. And as the phrase goes, to cut a long story short, I just said, went ahead and made all sorts of details, made inquiries with the government about opening a museum, because at that particular time, you couldn't come over and do a job that a Manxman could do. If it was a professional job, like a doctor or a curate or a dentist or something of that nature, then you could get permission. But otherwise, if you were going to take the occupation away from a Manxman, you couldn't come over. So I just made inquiries. Oh, yes, you can come and open the museum. So right, this is it. Made inquiries about the place and started negotiations then to buy it. And over we came. I think this was in 77. We were over in the next year.
So you didn't mess around with that one. Huge year for you last year, your 100th birthday, and you did that. There was a party for you at Government House, wasn't there? What was that like?
That was strange, because I knew that somebody was arranging a birthday for me due to the Burma Star Association, which has been... It was closing down at that time anyway, the actual Burma Star itself. But all my friends, we'd regularly had meetings. And as my birthday was coming along, a very good friend of mine, living up in Onken, said, look, we're arranging a party and you can come up to my place and we'll have a party at my house. Now, this was all a facade, as far as I can make out, because in the end, they must have got in touch with the governor, told the governor that I was 100, and instead of going to this private house with the large garden, we stopped at we were driving up, and you had to go past the governor's house to get to this place at Onken. We stopped, and the person who was taking me up there said, oh, wait a minute, I've got to call in here. I said, oh, all right. So I sat in the car. And then they came out, and the governor came out. Goodness, the party was here, not in the house, but in Government House.
What a lovely way to spend a 100th birthday. You're a member of the Burma Star Association, now known as the Burma Star Memorial Fund. Does that go any way toward making up for the Burma veterans being, for so long, effectively the forgotten army?
Well, it's always been understood, and it's continued to be understood, because... There's so much about the European war that was reported and not the Burma war in Burma. Now, my brother, he was actually fighting in Europe. He was landed on D-Day. He was a veteran landing on D-Day on the beach, one of the first landings. And unfortunately, he was wounded on the beach on that particular landing. He didn't spend much half the day in there, I think, before he was evacuated. But apart from that, I was writing to him, as many other people, and then when the actual decision for the end of the European war, when Hitler and everything else was, the Germans decided to capitulate, then my brother wrote to me, he said, oh, look, he said, there's all sorts of celebrations going on round here. He says, but nobody's thinking about you out there. And he actually wrote that in a letter.
That must have really brought it home to you as well at that stage.
Because we were still fighting.
And that went on for a long time and could have gone on for a lot longer.
Well, I don't know about a long. It was at least 2 months anyway. And as I say, if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb, it would have gone on longer.
Last year, after celebrating your 100th birthday, you represented Burma veterans at the Cenotaph in London at Remembrance. What was that like to do?
That was very interesting. I was going to say being a Londoner, but I'm not a Londoner, I'm from Lancashire. But as I finished up my days in the army, then I went to London because of the reasons for the jobs that I was going to do as a designer in advertising. And therefore, I spent my life then in Kingston-on-Thames, the outskirts of London. And so I was travelling in and out to London. I got very familiar with London, and that was a second home to me. In fact, I consider myself that I've had three different homes. All of them have been very well placed, and all of them I've enjoyed every one. My first was when I was a child going up to the war in Lancashire and learning all I did learn there. From then after the war, it was essential that I had to go where my type of work was necessary or better to do, and that was London. And then from London, I came to the Isle of Man, and I've been here ever since. So it's three distinct journeys in my life.
And we're here today in your lovely home, overlooking the beautiful sea and skies. It started raining a little bit now, but at Port Erin here on the Isle of Man. When you reflect on all that you went through 80 years ago, what are your thoughts about what you went through at that time?
Thinking back about some of the things that happened, you always go back, or at least I do anyway, to both the very good incidents and the very bad ones. And the bad ones are easy to remember, so are the good ones. And the ones in Burma, there were three or four occasions in Burma when you know, it was really, we were in a really serious situation. And I often, or on these three occasions, I remember distinctly what they were. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know whether I'm going to get out of this.
And as you look back now, do you consider the effort that, and the cost in lives, everything else, to be worthwhile? You look back all these 80 years?
Well, I don't know. I have been lucky, you see. So many people, I mean, I could just have easily died, but I didn't want to think about that. But, of course, so many people that I know in Burma that never survived. And, you know, they were all part of the situation that has improved or tried to improve the world as it was at that time.
And just a last question for you, James. If you tomorrow were to walk out into Port Erin, go for a walk, and I know you're keen on walking still, and you bumped into the 18-year-old version of yourself, what would you say to him? What advice would you give 18-year-old James?
I'd say, do it all again exactly as you do, because so many things, I've tried to look after myself, and I think that's the main thing, both food-wise, occupation, and although I must so this is going to be interesting, and it's in my book as well, because I started smoking at a very early age, long before I left secondary school. I think I must have been 12 or so, and it was a friend. It's always the situation. A friend, he's older than me, he started smoking, giving me cigarettes. So that was the beginning. And then it got up until after the war, I was smoking through the war, and we were getting issued with free cigarettes in India. And I realised, I think, well, this is not... Everyone else then was saying, oh, you shouldn't smoke, or they were saying that, even though there were so many smokers about. So I thought, no, I'll try to give up. I think I made a couple of attempts before I finally did, and never looked back on that side of it, really. And food as well. I've always been careful to try and eat the right things. I think, you know, look after myself in that way.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure and a real honour to meet you. Thank you for talking to us today. Thank you.
Thank you. It's really been nice meeting you.